and we'll get started.
Awesome.
All right. So welcome to the Intervention Podcast. Today, we are very happy to be joined once again by prolific author, human rights lawyer, and anti-imperialist activist Dan Kovalik. Dan has been on our show a couple of times in the past to discuss the on-the-ground situation in Eastern Ukraine and his fantastic recent book, Nicaragua, A History of U.S. Interventionism and Resistance. Today, Dan joins us on the heels of a recent trip to the West Bank. So Dan, so glad to have you back and grateful that you are safe, given Israel's penchant for murdering journalists and activists.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, you know, good a place to start as any. Could you just give us a rundown of your itinerary of your visit? Who did you talk to? When did it occur? And just give us kind of like a brief synopsis and we can go from there.
Yeah, so I traveled to Jordan, Amman, Jordan. I guess I arrived there December 1st, then crossed over by land, across the King Hussein Bridge, which takes you across the Dead Sea into Palestine, because the Tel Aviv airport is basically not functioning. Israel doesn't want to admit that, but it's not entirely closed, but there's very few airlines flying out of there. I checked the itinerary, it would take 45 hours to fly there. There's no U.S. airlines flying in or out of the Tel Aviv airport. So the only way to get in, practically speaking, is through Amman. By the way, the first city you see when you go into Israel-Palestine is Jericho, which is still a walled city, if you know your Bible, right? The wall came tumbling down at some point. And it's the oldest continuous city on Earth, which is interesting. It's also at the lowest elevation in the world. It's at over 500 meters below sea level.
Did not know that.
Yeah, and that's a Palestinian city.
Well, they all are, right?
Yes. Well, and I guess I meant to, what I'm trying to say is Palestinians live there. It's not a Israeli city.
No, I know. I'm being a little cheeky, but
Yeah, no. But just to give the lay of the land, though I noticed a lot of the bottled water came from Jericho. So they obviously have water there, but it's surrounded by desert. So you first drive through the desert to get in to either Ramallah or Jerusalem. I went to Ramallah. I stayed in Ramallah, which is in Area A, if you know the area system under the Oslo agreements, which is now part of Israeli law. You have areas A, B, and C. Area A, under the law, says that Israelis are not allowed to enter. It's just for it's Palestinian under the Palestinian Authority. Area B, it is Israelis may enter, but only with notice and only when necessary. And Area C, essentially, they can enter at will. Although, as people say now, you know, in effectively everything's Area C now because the Israelis enter as they. But that's not the law. Again, it's not Israeli law. It's not international law at this point because the international community accepted the Oslo agreements. But first, just to, again, so people understand the lay of the land. So you travel about an hour, and again, mostly through the desert, and you'll go a long way without seeing any people, any structures, you know, for people, except for you will see the Bedouin nomad community, the community that does live in the desert, and they have a pretty rough existence, mostly like tin, very rudimentary tin housing, and their own kind of, you know, tanks for water, because again, they're very dry out there. And they're very much a persecuted community. They're Palestinians, but they have a different lifestyle. Sure. And they're very much persecuted by the Israelis who try to push them out too. Though the Bedouin are pretty stubborn people. They're not easy to push around so much. And then you get to where I got to Ramallah, where I stayed. And I should just say, in some of these things, honestly, I apologize. I have a little bit of a cold, so I have.
Traveling will get you.
Sound like Rod Stewart today. So in any, in some of these things, I didn't know until I went there. So in order to, when you cross the King Hussein Bridge, you go through Jordanian customs on the way out, and you go through Israeli customs on the way into Israel-Palestine. I was very lucky that I did not have any problems. I was told, don't tell them you're going to Ramallah. Tell them you're going to Jerusalem and you're there on a Christian pilgrimage, which is what I said. And that got me through. They didn't bother me at all. Though I'll tell you an interesting little, you know, every little tidbits that I think are interesting to people. First of all, the one thing that I took note of is that when we were driving into Israeli customs, there was a line of oil tank, and they all had Arabic language on the tanker, signifying that the Arab states are still providing oil and gasoline to Israel.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Arab countries, by and large, are not helping Palestine. Jordan has provided tanks to Israel during this period, even after October 7th. The UAE has provided some armaments. In all the countries are providing oil. The only real standout is Yemen, of course, which right. is little mm-hmm. Yemen, which is playing a heroic, oversized role in supporting the Palestinians. So shout out to them. So I got through Israeli customs, and a student of mine, very nice woman named Yara, she studied at Pitt with me at the Pitt Law School. She's Palestinian. She went back home. Lives in Ramallah. She ordered a cab for me to pick me up at the end of the bridge. And you have, in order for that to happen, the cabbie has to have a yellow Israeli license plate because Palestinians cannot move freely at all. Israelis can move around at will. You know, but interesting. So the person who picked me up did have the Israeli yellow tag, but they weren't an Israeli. It was a Palestinian born in Jerusalem. If a Palestinian's born in Jerusalem, they're a Jerusalem resident. They get a yellow tag, which gives them freedom, most freedom of movement. And they get a Jordanian passport. They don't get an Israeli passport. They get a Jordanian. Because remember that the West Bank was a Jordanian protectorate up till between, I think, the early 1950s and 1967.
Right.
The 1967 war. So it was a Palestinian who picked me up, but he had the yellow plate, and he got me to Ramallah, which is an interesting place. It's a very big city. I mean, not real big, but, you know, I would say certainly on par with a Pittsburgh or a Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty safe place. And when I say safe, I mean, there's not much crime there, but the lack of safety comes because the Israeli troops do invade there quite a bit at will. And in fact, the place I was staying, so I stayed with a woman and her husband, Amal and Mohammed. I met Amal, wonderful person in Syria. And she and her husband, Mohammed, are very active. They were both arrested during the first Intifada. They were deported at that time. Obviously, they made their way back to Palestine. They lived in Ohio for a while. Actually, all three of their kids went to Ohio State. They're Buckeyes. Interesting enough. And about a month before I got there, Israelis had broken down their door, entered the apartment building, which they own, and arrested a young man there, a young Palestinian. And in the process of all this, shot and killed two people, two Palestinians. Jesus. And then took that prisoner back up the hill to the Israeli settlement where there's a Israeli military encampment. And on their way out of town, and actually Amal didn't know this, is interesting. I met a journalist there who told me on that day as they were leaving Amal's house, and he didn't know it was Amal's house, but I told him. He said, yeah, when they left that house, he showed me from the top of his building. He's a, you know, he's a reporter. He said the Israeli soldiers came up the street and they saw me and my cameraman up top. And they shot at me for no particular reason, except that he was up there. I mean, there was, and he was shot in the leg. He said, if there was, he showed me this big wall of glass in front of him. He said, if that weren't there, would have shot him, would have hit him in the head. But he said that he would have been the third person to die that day. And also when I was there one morning at about 4 a.m., and by the way, that's pretty much when the Israelis come, around 3 or 4 in the morning. They like to attack at night, arrest people in the middle of the night when they're sleeping, to really add to the terror, right?
Yeah. Because
a lot of this is to terrorize.
The most moral army in the world, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so one morning at 4 a.m., they came into Ramallah, and they went and they shut down a printing company and took their printing press because the owner of it is a political prisoner, of course, they call a terrorist. So they shut it down, took the printing press and put some, you know, placard up saying this is a shop of a terrorist and it's, you know, closed until further notice, whatever. And there were some skirmishes between them and people who tried to defend the printing company with stones. And again, that's pretty much a regular occurrence is, you know, since October 7th, there's really been an increase in violence and aggression by the Israeli armed forces and settlers, many times in conflict with one another, against the Palestinians in the West Bank, even though, of course, the West Bank, we should point out, is run by the Palestinian Authority, not Hamas, by the Palestinian Authority, which at this point, the ruling party is the Fatah party, the party of Yasser Arafat, which has a go-along, get-along attitude with Israel. I mean, they collaborate with Israel is the truth of it. But nonetheless, Israel treats them like they're terrorists, even though they do pretty much everything Israel tells them to do. And since October 7th, between the settlers and Israeli armed forces, they've killed around 300 Palestinians in the West Bank, which is much more than were killed in all of 2022, just to put that in some perspective. And they arrested, since October 7th, about 3,000 Palestinians from the West Bank. I mean, that's an extreme number of people, mostly young men, but some children and women as well. And you know, so when there was this prisoner hostage exchange a few weeks ago, and Israel gave back something like, 250 prisoners, I guess, many of them children, they took many more people,
right?
You know, in the last week. So, I mean, the point is they've replenished their jail cells with people.
With political prisoners.
As political prisoners, many held under what is called administrative detention, which means they don't even charge you with anything. They just take.
Right.
And I met one young man. He's 18 now, but he was arrested when he was 17. He was a few weeks from his final exams in high school. And they arrested him from school, which is, again, very typical. They like to arrest people very shortly before graduation to interfere with their education. It's all very orchestrated, again, to undermine Palestinian society, create terror. He was arrested. He was forced to, essentially, they put him on a march for 8 miles up a mountain before they put him in jail. And he was held for 8 months. Put in solitary confinement for the first few days. Had no communication with his family. After that, he had communication with his family once a month. Can you imagine that? You're 17 and you're, you know.
Yeah, you're a kid.
Yeah. He was. He did go before court, but they only spoke Hebrew. He speaks Arabic, and they provided no translation. So, I mean.
Fair. Due process. Yeah. Everything you expect from a democratic society.
Right. His charges were in a secret file only the judge could see. So he didn't even know what he was charged with. But he said his treatment wasn't horrible until October 7th. And then things really changed. They started to really abuse the prisoners. And so at that point, he was put in a jail cell. He had been in a jail cell with a total of six people. They then moved him to a jail cell with 12 or 13 people. They would periodically send in these special units that would beat people up, including him. For a meal, they would give the entire cell one plate of food to share. The whole cell shared one plate of food.
Oh, my God.
And so he said they were basically starving. And they, at one point after October 7th, the special unit came in, took every possession they had except for one blanket. They took the beds. They took the sheets, radios, TVs, whatever people had. And took all their clothes except the clothes on their back. So then they just wore the same clothes for weeks on end and were able to shower in a cold shower once a week. And again, subjected to beatings periodically. And the people treated the worst were the Gazans. Some Gazans were brought into the prison and they were abused even worse. And then so finally, he was released during the prisoner exchange. And as his mom told me, I visited his family. She told me that, you know, he's still traumatized. Not surprisingly. And he did. He looked like a, like he had this very doe. He looked like a doe, you know, a deer.
Yeah. Deer in the headlights, kind of. Yeah.
He looked like deer in the headlights. I think he still doesn't know what happened to him or why, you know. And again, that's very typical of this situation. They're, you know, they're trying to particularly target young men of fighting age and try to demoralize, you know, and break down their will to resist. I also, well, so another interesting thing. So on my first night there, I met this journalist I already talked to you about named Haldun, really nice guy. And he introduced me to his mentor, the guy he described as his mentor, a guy named Yuri Davis. Fascinating guy, 77 years old. He has Israeli British citizenship. He was born in what then was Palestine in 1946. So he had Israeli citizenship when Israel was created in 1948, but he had British citizenship because Palestine was a British protectorate for sometime in 1948. And he is Jewish as well. So he's, you know, kind of an interesting guy, but he works for the Fatah party, which is the ruling party of the Palestinians in the West Bank. So fascinating guy. And he wrote a book in 1987 saying that Israel was an apartheid state. I think that made him a very early proponent of that theory.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking at dinner and I mentioned, I said, well, you know, I'd like to go to Bethlehem because, you know, as a someone raised Catholic, I said to go there at this time would be really interesting. But I said I was told that the chances of getting that were getting there was slim to nil because of all the Israeli checkpoints and because the Israelis were not in the mood to let people into Bethlehem at this time. But Yuri said, you know what? I'll take you. He says, I've done this for 50 years. We'll go as foreign tourists. You're an American. I'm a Brit. And I'll take you there. And then why did we have to go as foreign tourists? Because a couple reasons. Palestinians would not have the freedom to travel there, number one. Number two, because Bethlehem's in Area A, technically Israelis aren't allowed in there. So his Israeli passport would not help him. So we would have to go under his British passport and me under my American passport. which think about it for one second. Me as an American have more freedom of movement than a Palestinian who's lived there, their families lived there for millennia.
Yeah, I mean, people think that we're being out of line or just hyperbolic when we talk about the apartheid conditions, right? I think they think it's just a slogan. But I remember, because you mentioned the license plate aspect of this, as I was coming to consciousness about the situation in Palestine, that was something that, again, even very early on, as I was trying to understand the situation, that just screams apartheid separateness. So, I mean, just as you're describing the situation here, I mean, I don't know how we could call it anything but.
No, exactly. And as the South Africans say, it's a form of apartheid that's worse than was in South Africa for a couple of reasons. First of all, South Africa didn't have these separation walls all over the place. And these walls are bigger, they're higher, and they're longer, much longer than the Berlin Wall, right? Mm-hmm. That everyone derided, and Reagan said, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. Well, there's, as you know, walls throughout the West Bank, especially in Jerusalem. This beautiful ancient city is just pockmarked by these disgusting walls that mostly separate Palestinians from Israelis, but in some cases actually separate Palestinians from one another. So the guy who showed me around Jerusalem took me to this wall, and he said, this wall comes through an old Palestinian neighborhood. He said, there are families on both sides of the wall, people related to each other, who used to be able to walk over and see each other in 10 minutes. He said, now it takes them 2 hours to go visit each other because of the wall. The other thing they use the walls for, they're re-engineering Jerusalem to try to guarantee a majority Israeli population in Jerusalem. So what they've done is they've added settlements that are physically outside Jerusalem, but counting it as part of Jerusalem to add the Israeli population. And then at the same time, they're walling out Palestinian neighborhoods that are technically in Jerusalem, in the city limits, but then designating that as outside the city limits, right? So they can make sure that they have more Israelis than Palestinians.
Yeah, it sounds like an even more fascistic form of gerrymandering.
Yeah, but it affects, of course, your daily living, and it cuts family off from family, and again, the freedom of movement of people. And that's what people have to realize. I mean, just how constricted people are. And, you know, like Ramallah, which again is like a major city. Think of it as like Pittsburgh. They have it surrounded with walls and gates, and they can shut that, they can lock that city down in moments if they shut those gates. And in fact, they did after October 7th. They kept it locked down for 3 weeks, which means you could not enter the city, nor could you leave it. And if you were outside the city, if you lived in the city and you were outside it when they shut those gates, you can't go home. And if you're in a village that they locked down, that is like, at least Ramallah has a hospital and it's got clinics and it has all the amenities alike. So being locked down there isn't the worst in the world. But if you're locked down in a little village, a remote village, you're cut off from the amenities of life. So if you need to go to the hospital outside the village, tough luck. And there are cases of women who have been giving birth who get to the gate and they can't get through. Some give birth in their car at the gate. Some women have lost children trying to do that. You know, so it's really, again, that is not something you saw in South Africa. The other difference between the apartheid in Israel and the apartheid in South Africa is that the white settlers in South Africa were not attempting to get rid of the black population. They wanted to keep them down and separate, but they needed them to work. They needed them to work in the mines, the diamond mines and all that, and do all the dirty jobs for them. They weren't trying to get rid of them. Israel wants to get rid of the Palestinians. I mean, they do want to just remove them, if not from the face of the earth, at least push them out into Jordan, into Egypt, and get rid of them. Again, that was not true in South Africa.
Talking about apartheid and what you actually saw there, and you mentioned your Catholic heritage and visiting Bethlehem, Ta-Nehisi Coates last month visited the West Bank and understood what he saw there as, quote, quite familiar to those of us familiar with African-American history. So not to focus on our feelings as Americans, but I'm just wondering, what did you come away after witnessing and learning all of this feeling about this injustice?
Well, as I remarked to my Palestinian friends there, I said, you know, if I lived in this country, I'd be angry every day, especially if I were Palestinian, but I'd be angry if I were just me, because the inconveniences are incredible because of the situation. I'll just give one little example. So I went from Ramallah to Jerusalem. That's 8 miles. Okay. That's nothing. That should take you 10, 15 minutes. Took me an hour and a half because they shut down one of the gates close to Ramallah. I had to go all the way around. Cost me $100 on a taxi. Again, I'm not complaining, but what I'm saying is this is life in this area, you know? And if you're a Palestinian, of course, it's worse. And you every time a Palestinian goes to a checkpoint, they don't know if they're going to be merely arrested or even killed, right? I mean, they are treated like garbage. And that is very apparent. And it's very upsetting. By the way, the reason that crossing that day was closed is because there's a refugee camp right near that crossing. And the Israeli security forces had gone into that camp and they arrested someone. They shot 5 people, killed 1 person. They also took all these goods of merchants and threw them in a dumpster, and it was mostly food. Throwing away people's food. You know, again, this is just a daily occurrence. They do these things.
Yeah.
They, you know, just to humiliate people and to undermine their morale. Again, I'm amazed at how patient the Palestinian people are. I mean, and how kind they are given this. I think I would be a very unhappy, angry person. Probably not very fun to be around, you know. But meanwhile, you know, every family I visited, even if they had just lost a loved one a week before, and I met a family whose son, who was a mere bystander to the Israelis arresting someone, he wasn't doing anything except looking, was shot to death with 4 bullets, four butterfly bullets. And the Israelis just left. They didn't check on him, didn't call for medical care. So I met that family and they took me into their home. They gave me coffee. They gave me candies. And that's true. Every family you meet is going to give you coffee, going to give you a little treat. And you're just saying, Jesus Christ, you know, in Pittsburgh, God, I go to someone's house, they don't offer me tap water.
maybe an icy light, but.
Maybe an icy light. But, you know, it's pretty amazing the hospitality of Palestinians, which is famous. And really, of all the people in the Levant, which includes Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, these are very hospitable, kind people. And their patience, their fuse is very, very, very long.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I also noticed, you know, I had just been in Cairo 2 weeks before that. The one thing I noticed about Cairo was that all you hear all day are honking horns. I mean, if you're in a car, you're just amazed. Everyone just has their hand on their horn, almost like incessantly. You didn't hear that at all. In Palestine, people weren't honking at each other. People weren't yelling at each other. In Cairo, everyone was yelling at each other. It's not an aggressive society. It's a very passive society. And I don't mean passive in a, you know, a way, you know, meaning they lay down for people, but it's just a very peaceful society and very placid, especially in the villages. I went to this ancient village and I'm not just saying this. I mean, I was really overwhelmed with a feeling of peacefulness. It just was like, oh man, it is relaxed here. And life is slow and it's nice. And again, if left to their own devices, it would be that way every day. But then the Israelis come in and they they stir things up and they interrupt that peace.
Definitely. I'm curious, Dan, and you know, I think what you're saying is so important, because I think a big part of what we have to try to do in absence of actually getting, you know, to speak with actual Palestinians, or to at least take your experience from, you know, that you had with them, is to humanize these people. Because I right. think they want us to try to think, the imperial media wants us to think of these as these people as terrorists, right? We can't associate them with just, again, having people over for coffee. So I think that's a big, important thing that we have to do, is just to get people to have, again, you know, we can talk about the politics, materialism, the history and everything like that, but just to get to people on like a human level. And I think that's really important. So, you know, it sounds like just the day-to-day existence, obviously, between the West Bank and Gaza is a little bit different, both horrific. Yes. And I'm talking about like as a baseline before October 7th. So, you know, these walls didn't just go up. The checkpoints didn't just go up. These gates have always been there. Can you speak to, you know, we touched on the political prisoner situation a little bit earlier and how Israel's treatment of them ramped up, or maybe deteriorated is the right way to say it, following October 7th. But did you get a sense in talking to people how things may have escalated? We know that there's been almost 300 Palestinians killed just in the West Bank alone. And by rights, I think we would consider what's going on a third intifada in many ways, if we were just looking at the West Bank in the absence of the genocide ongoing in Gaza right now. But how has Israel ramped up its behavior upon the foundation of like these apartheid mechanisms that they already have in place since then?
Yeah, well, again, in addition to the arrests, the 3,000 arrests, in addition to 300 murders, basically, of people, they're also increasing the demolition of Palestinian homes, particularly in Jerusalem. I mean, a couple of people told me Jerusalem is getting the hardest hit in the West Bank. And why? Because this is some of the most contested territory, because as people may or may not know, East Jerusalem is under international law, because of the Oslo Accords, it is supposed to be under the control of the Palestinian Authority. It's supposed to be Palestinian. And it is to be the capital of a state, Palestinian state, under the Oslo Accord, which Israel agreed to. But Israel is hell-bent on taking all Jerusalem, including East Jerusalem, and they consider all Jerusalem their capital. And of course, the only country in the world that recognizes it as such outside Israel is the United States. And that happened for the first time under Donald J. Trump, who recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is an incredibly provocative move, you know, because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is third most important Muslim holy site, is in East Jerusalem. Also, let us not forget, some of the most important Christian sites in the world are in East Jerusalem. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that is said to have held the remains of Jesus Christ, and that he arose from there. Of course, it was a cave originally. It's now a church. Is there the church that is said to house the body of the Virgin Mary is there. The Mount of Olives is there, Gethsemane, where Jesus was crucified, is there. This is the Holy Land. This is where the Wailing Wall for Jews is there. For the three major religions, I mean, this is a very important place. And now Israel is saying it wants sole dominion over this. And again, the U.S. is a party to that. And Biden didn't countermand Trump's, you know, position on
it. Of course, yeah.
Well, he actually doubled down on it on July 15th. He stated that that is the capital of Israel.
Yeah, and the U.S. has an embassy and consulate there. So it's very, very provocative for people. And the other thing, like even the lawyer, I think he's a lawyer, but he's a human rights advocate in any case, who showed me around Jerusalem. He's a Palestinian and he was born in Jerusalem. So he does have the yellow tag on his car, but even he cannot go into the old city. Under new regulations, Palestinians who don't live in the old city can't go in the old city. And that's where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, and that's where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is, and that's where the Wailing Wall is at. So the most important part of Jerusalem, most Palestinians are not allowed in. And Palestinians that don't have the yellow tag, which is most Palestinians, can't get into Jerusalem, period. Which is just absolutely incredible. Of course, I can freely go in any of those areas as an American who has no connection to Palestine or Israel at all. You know, it's really incredible. I mean, again, just kind of a stream of consciousness. The other thing about the apartheid is that if you go into the Palestinian sections, again, particularly of Jerusalem, where the contrasts are the starkest, you know, the Palestinian neighborhoods are run down. The roads are bad. The trash collection's bad. There's trash everywhere. It's very sad, in truth. And by the way, for the last 4 months or so, Israel has not been shamed. They're supposed to, the Palestinians and Israelis pay taxes to the same place, okay? And the Israelis are supposed to share the taxes with the Palestinian authorities so they can provide services for the Palestinian people, right? Well, they have not been sharing taxes for at least 4 months. So they're just starving these neighborhoods and these towns and cities of tax revenue. In fact, people work for the Palestinian Authority have not been paid for 4 months. Can you believe it?
But this all started on October 7th.
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, the beginning of history was October 7th. Right. Just like the collapse of the Soviet Union was the end of history.
Right.
But then if you go into the Israeli settlements, which I did, literally if you were blindfolded and you were brought there, you would think you were in the Gold Coast of Chicago. Okay? I mean, it just, you'd eat off the streets, incredible shopping districts with Best Western shops, incredible, beautiful parks, you know. And they have their own trolley line that connects the settlements. So they don't have to deal with all this bullshit of the checkpoints and the gates and all that stuff. And they've built all sorts of infrastructure so Israelis don't have to deal with Palestinians. They had an expressway through Jerusalem that goes over a Palestinian neighborhood. So the Israelis can just ride over the Palestinians, don't have to look at them, deal with them. It's just a terrible situation. And again, there's no way to even debate the point that it's an apartheid state. No. I mean, it's a almost admittedly so. They don't use the word, but almost every word they use points to the fact that it's an apartheid state. And so Jerusalem in particular, but throughout the West Bank, the settlers are getting more aggressive in ousting Palestinians from their homes, seizing their homes, destroying their homes. By the way, if you're a Palestinian and your home is marked for demolition, you either have to demolish your house yourself or you have to pay for the demolition. Can you imagine? God. It's like in a fascist dictatorship where they'd shoot a guy and they sent the bill to the family for the bullet. The same deal. And so Jerusalem people are pretty miserable. I mean, the Palestinians are because the pressure is exceedingly high there. But throughout the West Bank, it is. And I think it's going to boil over in a couple of ways. One, not just against the Israelis, but against the Palestinian Authority, which is not defending the Palestinians, which is collaborating with the Israelis. The Palestinian Authority police arrest people for the Israelis. They've been tamping down on pro-Gaza protests. I think the Palestinian Authority is going to have a rude awakening. It will not last all this.
Yeah, and that's something I think we wanted to get to, but how are Palestinians in the West Bank understanding what's going on in Gaza at the moment with respect to their own history and identity as Palestinians? Again, in the anecdotal conversations you would have, is it connected? I mean, I would anticipate that it is, but interested to hear what people are saying.
Well, people on a daily basis are devastated by it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, before the Oslo Accords, people told me they could drive to Gaza in half an hour. That blew my mind. I mean, when I think of the West Bank and Gaza, they seem like they could be on other ends of the earth, but they're only like a half hour away, again, without partitions and all that. Now they're completely, you can't get from one to the other at all, period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the people in the West Bank are devastated by what's happening. The people I was with would not go out to restaurants, would not go out drinking. The people who hosted me, their daughters getting married this week, actually, I think in a couple of days. The wedding was canceled. They had already paid for it. They canceled it. They're going to still get married, but they're going to only do it with family because no one celebrated. And in Bethlehem, you might have seen that the Christian patriarchs sent a letter to Joe Biden saying they had canceled Christmas. That's their word.
Mm-hmm.
They canceled. They said as long as, you know, the suffering's happening in Gaza, they're not going to celebrate Christmas. They're not going to have, there were no lights up, no Christmas trees, even in Manger Square, nothing, because they just feel hurt by what's happening and there's nothing to celebrate. And everyone told me that. I mean, people are very depressed. I met with a student, I have a couple students of mine from Pitt Law School. They were on a open society fellowship at Pitt. So every year I taught at Pitt. In 2012 and 2023, almost every year I had at least one Palestinian. And some of them were from Gaza. Some of them were from the West Bank. I should say my student from Gaza, Khalil Al-Wazir, who's named after his uncle, the legendary Khalil Al-Wazir, who was number two to Arafat. So he was assassinated. The last I heard from him was a few weeks ago, and he had moved from Gaza City to the middle of Gaza, where he was living like a Bedouin. He was cooking food on a fire and spending the day trying to find water, he and his wife and his child. And I haven't heard from him for a few weeks. I have no idea if he's alive or he's dead. My students in the West Bank, I met two of them, Yara and Bassan. And again, Yara did go out with me, but she just told me, she said, you know, I'm just going out for you because you're here and I want you to have a good time. And but she said, I don't go out. This is the first time I've gone out since October 7th and I won't go out again because I'm not going to. And in fact, I had to beg her to eat something. I said, come on, we're here. Let's have some little wine, a little food. I said, do it for my sake, you know, and I had to beg her to eat because she just did not want to do anything to celebrate, you know, given what was happening. And that's the prevailing view of people in the West Bank.
Yeah, the patriarch has really been speaking forcefully against this ongoing genocide in Gaza, which seems to indicate a growing world sympathy with the Palestinian resistance. So you've described these physical walls separating the Palestinians from their homeland, from each other, from the world. But there are also these walls of censorship and propaganda that are continuing to attempt to silence their voices. But these walls, as I said, they seem to be falling. So sharing only as much as discretion allows, are there any specific messages that you heard from Palestinians in the West Bank that they want the world to hear, that they want to say to an American audience that you're speaking to right now?
Well, obviously the biggest message that they have is they want the U.S. support for this military assault to end. I mean, they blame the Americans first. Let me be clear about that. They believe this is made in the USA, this abomination that's happening in Gaza. They hold the United States responsible for it, and they want this to end. And what they made it clear to me is that the protests in the US have given them hope. I mean, they really appreciate it. They're really glad people are on the streets, and they're shocked by it. I think we all are. I think we're all a little surprised how big these protests are. It's the first time I've ever seen that in support of Palestinians. And the Palestinians are very happy about it. And they, you know, they're very clear. They want that to continue. And they want people to continue talking about Palestine, exposing the crimes that are happening there. And that's why people went out of their way for me. People would drop everything they were doing to take me around, to show me around, to introduce me to people, because they want me to go back and tell their stories. In fact, I am writing a book right now called The Case for Palestine, and a lot of what I saw there is going to be in that book. I'm putting stuff up on social media too, and they're very excited about that. I sent them an interview I did, and they're very happy about that. They, you know, they desperately want this assault on Gaza to, and they want the repression in the West Bank to end as well. But, you know, obviously they know there's more urgency to what's happening in Gaza, because you now have something like 15,000 known dead, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 dead children, 20,000 to 30,000 orphans that they know of. Over 100 historic sites have been destroyed, including the third oldest Christian church in the world, the Rafah Museum with ancient antiquities and relics has been destroyed. All those relics are beneath rubble right now. Over half the population of Gaza is now starving. I mean, everyone acknowledges. And the last figure I saw is 1.8 million out of the 2.3 million Gazans is now internally displaced. This is a humanitarian nightmare on a scale, honestly, we've never seen, in terms of, again, the rate of civilians being killed, the percentage of civilians being killed, the number of journalists being killed, the number of hospitals destroyed, the number of UN staff people killed, over 130 UN staff people being killed and counting, the most since, by far, since the United Nations was founded. This is staggering. It's absolutely, on any measure you would have of a conflict, this is awful. This is despicable. And every day it's getting worse. Every day you hear of a new atrocity. Just when you thought it couldn't get worse, it gets worse. You know, and they even shot those three, their own freaking hostages. Three Israeli hostages were shot. They had white flags up. One of them spoke Hebrew to them to say, hey, I'm with you guys. They shot them anyway. And they either did it on purpose as part of this Hannibal directive, or they're just doing it as part of their rules of engagement, which is to shoot everything that moves. I mean, they're just shooting everyone in sight.
Yeah.
And the U.S. is not putting up, you know, they're not saying boo. I mean, Biden will say something, Blinken will say something. Ah, we told them, try to go a little easy on the civilians. But meanwhile, we keep sending them weapons.
The weapons don't stop.
The weapons don't stop. We just sent them 2,000-pound bombs. What the hell do you do with 2,000-pound bombs on an urban population? In Afghanistan, U.S. military leaders said they wouldn't use 500-pound bombs on an urban population because it's too indiscriminate. Yeah. Here they're using 200-pound bombs, 2,000-pound bombs on the most densely populated place on Earth.
And they have the audacity to come and say, oh, you know what? We're trying to tell them to be more targeted and more discriminate with their bombing. But to your point, with a bomb that size, how do you do that? I mean, we know that targeted precision bombing does not exist. It's never existed. But like, right, our government thinks we are stupid.
Yeah, no, they don't. They're just cool. You know, we used to call it cooling the mark, which I think is a gambling term. You cool the mark. They're just trying to somehow placate, particularly the Democratic base.
Yeah.
Nice guys. We're telling them to go easy on the civilians. But meanwhile, we're sending them weapons. Biden's been working behind the scenes to remove all human rights restrictions on Israel's ability to tap into the U.S. munitions and armament reserves. That's never been done before. So they are liars. They're liars. Biden and Blinken. These are awful people. I mean, I hate to say that, but I don't know how you could vote for them. I mean, I probably will vote for Cornel West or so. I just, what is happening blows my mind, to be honest. I've been in a lot of conflict zones in my life. I've studied a lot of conflict zones, and this is the worst.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, I talked to Chris Hedges when I was in Cairo, Egypt. And, you know, Chris Hedges won the Pulitzer Prize. He worked for the New York Times. He was stationed in Sarajevo during the war. He's been stationed in Gaza. He's been stationed all kinds of. And he told me, Dan, this is the worst I've ever seen. This is the worst I've ever known of. And if a guy like that tells you that, you got to take that to the bank. He knows what he's talking about, you know. So we have a responsibility to stop this, or at least to try to do everything we can. I mean, this is go time. I told people today, I actually gave a talk to the Marxist library out in Berkeley. And I said, you know, if you have any gas left in the tank, if you have any bullets left in the chamber, now's the time to use it. Now is the time. It's go time, baby. It is, you know, it's not time to pace yourself.
Definitely.
The right. Revolution is here, baby. Like, if you can't stand up for Palestinians right, then you're not going to stand up for anyone anytime. And, you know, I've seen that statement. If you know, if you're wondering what you do during the Holocaust, you know now. That's absolutely true.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm, definitely. If you want to know what it was to be an average German on the street, you know it. And so act accordingly.
Yep.
That's what I feel. I mean, and I'll speak to anyone. I'll give any talk at any time, even though I have, you know, laryngitis, whatever. I feel dedicated to these people. I love these people. And I do believe in, not just as a philosophical thing or as a slogan, I do believe that the liberation of the world is tied up in the liberation of the Palestinian people. I think it is one of the key questions in the world. And what side you come down on that says to me everything about you as a person. I mean,
definitely.
You know, as one person said, hey, we can disagree whether pineapples are proper topping on pizza, but I don't think there's any, I don't really have time to debate whether what's happening in Gaza is right. You know, I mean, that is not up for debate.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important, and you touched on this earlier, that Palestinians, maybe one source of hope is the fact that they're seeing these movements in the imperial core. I mean, not just in the US, but Canada and Europe, the streets are alive every night for Palestine, standing in solidarity with Palestine. So, I mean, for someone like, I think us, for people like us, I think there's a lot of hope there. And I think key to it, Dan, in my opinion, is that people are rejecting this both sides stuff. And they're starting to wake up to the fact that it is right to resist and that the U.S. empire is never on the right side of global conflict, ever, ever. So it gives me a little bit of hope for a true anti-imperialist movement in the U.S. And I think, you know, we have a responsibility to continue kind of carrying that forward for Palestinian liberation and really the liberation of all oppressed peoples, especially in the global South. So I don't know what your take is on this, and maybe we can wrap this here, but I do see, and I think it's tied to people saying, hey, we're not going to vote for Biden for supporting genocide. I think it's, again, the line that the people are adopting, and they're rejecting this kind of liberal both sidesism on this. But just want to see if you're sharing my optimism on that front.
No, of course I do. I do, because, I mean, because you're seeing the proof is in the pudding. And again, the Palestinian resistance, what you're seeing is this very small group of people, tiny group of people, really, relatively speaking. Very poorly armed, with no ally, very few state allies in the world of any seriousness, have now inspired mass movements around the world to rise up. And that's to your point. The anti-imperialist movement in the U.S. has been dead since 2003. And honestly, if the Democrats and the ruling class were smart, they would have left well enough alone. They would not have opened up this front. They would have continued to just badmouth Russia and say how they horrible they were in Ukraine. No, we couldn't get anyone on the street to try to support, to try to oppose U.S. military aid to Ukraine. That was a losing battle. They had, you know, the propaganda, and it was working there. All of a sudden, they've lost the entire moral high ground. They have no moral high ground. They can't point to Russia or China or anyone. They can't talk about human rights, though they still do. But it's a joke It's a freaking joke. They can't get up at a podium and talk about human rights without people thinking they're literally insane, because they're supporting the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. By the way, after they already supported what was the worst humanitarian disaster in Yemen.
Right.
And the Yemenis are the only people, by the way.
And they're still standing and fighting.
Kicking ass for the Palestinians. You know, we are all Yemen, I will say. But this is inspiring. And I think people need to be inspired. I think you need to be, on the one hand, horrified by what's happening, but also not demoralized. You need to look at the Palestinians and how they're holding up under this. You know, I saw a video, you've probably seen this video or ones like it. I saw a little girl, maybe 10 years old. They had pulled her from the rubble, and she was interviewed by a journalist. You know, how do you feel? Do you want to leave Gaza? And she goes, I'm never leaving Gaza.
I mean, they're heroes. They're heroes.
You can put me under the ground. I'll be a seed for the resistance. A people like that can't be defeated. This reminds me of the, you know, I love the Godfather films when Michael sees the gorillas in the Cuban streets, and the one gorilla blows himself up to kill a Cuban officer. And Michael says to Hyman Roth, he goes, or Hyman Roth says, well, what does that tell you? He says, they can win. And that's exactly what we're seeing with the Palestinian people. They can win and they will win. But in the meantime, the truth is there will be huge suffering. And that's why the call for a ceasefire is the just call. It's what the Palestinians want us to be calling for, because it is true, I think, that Israel has failed, is now in the death throes. Because the lie of what Israel is has now been exposed. The lie of what the United States is has been exposed. But on the negative, Gaza could be destroyed in the meantime. And it is being destroyed. Every day this goes on, there's more death and destruction. So we have a responsibility. That's what it comes down to. And there's protests, you know, every week, a couple here in Pittsburgh. There's one on Tuesday at 4:30 and at 310 Grant Street in front of the both U.S. Senators building. The Mennonites are leading that. You know, so get out there, grab your keffiyeh. If you don't have a keffiyeh, buy one and get out in the streets and do your duty as a human being.
Definitely. No. Well, Dan, thanks so much for the time, man. I'd love to talk to you about maybe setting up an in-person forum to pull in even some more people off the streets to hear what you have to say again, so we can get this perspective from the Palestinians. I think it's super important. So I'll catch up with you that. Maybe we can organize that at the Liberation Center. But just as always, man, we appreciate the work. We appreciate your commitment to the struggle. And just thanks for giving us your time tonight.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys, and happy holidays and happy new year to everyone.
Same to you. Take care.
Thanks.
All right. Well, that was Dan Kovalik, Pittsburgh-based activist, organizer, human rights lawyer, and author. This is just going to be, I think, kind of a post-mortem with the three of us to just dissect that conversation and give our thoughts for a little bit here. Stevie, you were relatively quiet. Why don't you give your thoughts to kick us off?
I guess more one thing that struck me, and more anecdotally, just based on people I speak to, I think it's going to be good for the more liberal-based people that need more convincing, and even just, you know, Americans in general. When he said about, you know, the license plates and not being able to move, because a lot of conversations I have when I say apartheid state, or I say open air prisoners, they're like, well, why don't they just leave? They can move. I mean, there's nothing stopping them from just going to an airport and leaving. I'm like, well, there's a lot stopping them. And to actually hear from someone who's been there, I think hopefully just helps get through to some people that we haven't gotten through to yet, you know?
Yeah. That concrete example, those concrete examples of this is a codified mechanism of preventing you from having freedom of movement, keeping you separate from your family, splitting communities in half. I mean, those are all very I mean, those are examples that speak volumes about the actuality of the situation in the West Bank. I mean, Gaza, we understand Gaza is its own enclosure, militarized border, you know, with enclosure with a militarized border by Israel. And then I think the West Bank, again, because of how complicated the results of the Oslo Accords were, it's tough for people to wrap their head around the exact mechanisms, but if you can give simple little examples like that, it's like you don't need to understand the nuances of Area B, Area A, B, or C to just understand that this is apartheid. This is a system of separateness.
And it's one thing, us saying it, and no matter how much research and how much reading and how much we study this stuff, it's one thing me telling somebody that I know that. And it's another thing them hearing from someone who's been there and experienced it. I just think that that can hit home more with certain people than anything I could say to them.
Definitely. And Levi, it reminds me of a little bit of our conversation with Sina. And we were talking about how, you know, to talk about Iran and the situation there, like you don't have to understand all of the nuances. You don't have to be able to write like a history paper that could get published on the situation here. If you can understand some of these concrete facts, I mean, that is enough to inform action.
Yeah, I mean, that's really something within capitalism to sort of drive this individualized notion that we have experts whose word has to be taken above any kind of human experience or understanding of the world we live in. And I mean, Dan mentioned just like the maddening inconvenience of having to take hours to move 8 miles, which might seem like small, but it's something you can really understand, especially compared to the fact that he said it took 30 minutes to get from Ramallah to Gaza before 1967. Like, these places are very intimately connected. Israel is not a big place, Israel-Palestine. And that feeling, the sort of human aspect of it, the maddening inconvenience, the maddening injustice that's just all around you when you're living or being inside an apartheid state, it's important that people know what that feels like, what that living in that area feels like. And it's even more important when he sort of described the general feeling of camaraderie and hospitality that the Palestinian people still hold, that as physically agonizing their lives must be, they still have not lost their cultural touchstone to their own inner humanity in the same way that we're seeing the IDF, the Israeli state, really losing their own touch with humanity while conflicting this amount of violence and inhumanity on another people.
Yeah, and the point you made, Nick, was good because, like you said, I mean, the media and certain people just want to paint Palestinians as terrorists, and to give them the humanity that Dan did is important for people to understand and to hear. I think that was, you made a good point at the time.
No, yeah. And that's just what I was going to say. That was my biggest takeaway. I mean, I think we all understand Palestinian humanity, but just to be able to put yourself into the shoes of someone going into a stranger's house and receiving a cup of coffee and a piece of cake and having a real human conversation. Like, I think if you have the level of empathy to be able to do that, it could change your entire perspective on this. And again, without even understanding the history entirely, but if you can couple these things that we talked about tonight, these apartheid conditions, and then these people are still maintaining their friendliness to strangers, welcoming people in, that basic humanity, that neighborliness. I mean, I would hope that someone could hear that. And if they were in the wrong position or maybe unclear, that could help them change. Because again, we can understand material conditions all we want, but I think things like that can really inspire people. And so I'm hoping that this helps at least get these perspectives out to inspire people to go fight.
Another anecdotal thing on that is, you know, Americans like to, I think they think of themselves as nice. And I think you guys can tell me if I'm wrong there, but, you know, nice and welcoming and friendly. But one thing, you know, again, I'm English, but my parents lived in Africa. We've lived in other places in Europe. And, you know, we would meet people when we were traveling, and my dad and, you know, we'd meet and strike up a conversation with, say, an American kid who was traveling. And my dad would say, like, well, if you're in the Netherlands and you, you know, you need somewhere to stay, give us a call. Here's our address. Here's our number. You're welcome to stay with us. And there's that. And then I remember, you know, I have a Dutch guy that I know and I've known since I was a kid, and he was in the US. And I said, well, why don't you come stay with my wife and I? And the point that he made to me was, because, you know, he knows I'm English, but he also knows I've lived a lot in America. He said, are you just saying that? And I said, what do you mean? Like, no, you're welcome to come. He goes, well, Americans always say stuff like this, but they don't really mean it. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't really welcome me in their house. They wouldn't have me in. And I'm like, listen, man, you can come to my house and you could stay. But I think it's a true reflection on Americans. I do think they portray this image of friendliness and like overly nice, but I really think a lot of them don't mean it. And I think there is a lack of hospitality in this country that you obviously see in other Western countries, but I don't think it's the case in a lot of the world, and especially in parts of the world which we would view as oppressed. And I think Americans would be surprised at how welcoming and how humane a lot of these people are.
No, absolutely. The other thing that I really want to drive home on this is America's complicity, both in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. Steve, you and I were talking this morning. I think an article came out recently. I can't remember where it was from, but you know, we always talk about these fascist settlers at the tip of the spear, driving new settlements, expansion into the occupied territories in Palestine. And a huge percentage of these people come from America. And they're, you know, supported in one way or the other by the state, by both states in this case. So on one hand, in Gaza, we've got American arms, again, going towards apparently sending 2,000-pound bombs to bomb an encampment, a refugee encampment at this point in time. And we've got American fascist settlers from Long Island, New York, and California driving continued oppression in the West Bank. So America's complicity just runs so deep.
Yeah, I think the comparison was made, or the observation was made, that the amount of pounds of bombs that are being let into Gaza far outstrips the amount of how many pounds of food are being allowed into Gaza. That's just insane. It's unfathomable the amount of carnage that's being unleashed on the world's most heavily populated area.
I mean, the last thing I think we want to drive home for people listening is that it was personally very encouraging to me to hear that what we're doing on the ground is making a difference in reaching people over there. I mean, even if it's just making somebody feel better about the situation that, like, hey, the Americans aren't all like bloodthirsty animals that support our fascistic oppressors. There's people there calling for a better world as well. So I think that should be, on a very human level, validation to anybody that's doing education, agitation, rallying in the streets, having tough conversations. You're making a difference on a very, again, human level. And I think that is going to be something that, you know, personally gives me a bit of a recharge after, you know, 2 months of organizing and educating here with you guys. But to hear that, I think was huge.
It's important, and we don't want to lose sight of that as an individualizing moment, but it's just so important not to get burned out in these kind of times, because it's so important, as Dan said, to really balance your work and put in the time, because this is one of those weeks that months happen. Things are happening every single day that on any other given day of the year would be cataclysmic on its own.
Well, what do you think, boys? You want to leave it there?
On that note, go out there, join your local left organizations, take your time, even if it's one day, if it's one march, if it's one meeting, if it's one class, just whatever time you have.
Yeah, definitely. Personal plug for PSL. For obvious reasons here, but go do what's accessible to you. Attend an educational forum. I mean, just to go out and talk with other like-minded people on this can be a good way to get inspired to do even more. Just breaking those feelings of isolation, if you are feeling isolated politically on this, given your specific circumstances. So it's always a good step to take if you can. But we thank Dan, obviously, for joining us tonight and giving us his perspective and, you know, taking the time out of his own life to go out and talk with these people and get a on-the-ground experience there. But yeah, as Levi said, go out, get organized. Thanks for listening to the Intervention Pod, and we'll talk to y'all next time.
Thank you.
Like, subscribe, leave reviews, and have a good night.
That's right.
Adios, paisanos.